And
well, we ended up, you were talking about Archer.
Yeah.
If you remember.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
His the momentary reorganization of the department.
Yeah.
This is the, what, the 23rd or the 24th of mm-hmm. November, second session.
Yeah.
So I would like to hear what you'd have to say about Harry Harlow.
Well, I think that I myself will remember Harry Harlow best, not only for the very important contributions he made to psychology, and especially with regard to the development of social relationships, of course, as a consequence of his research with the primates, but also for his interest in the psychology department. I mentioned the other day the great supposed ruling triumvirate, Harlow, Brogdon, and Grant. Well, one of the what I regard as very notable characteristics of these three is that they really had a great dedication to the welfare of the department and indeed of the university as a whole. They were strongly identified with the university.
That's interesting. I wouldn't have thought it of Harlow.
Oh, he was very, very identified with the university. He had been here since the 1930s. He told me that he had built the primate laboratory almost literally by hand, making use of leftover building supplies and the like. That, you know, well, he didn't, of course, do it all by himself.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was very involved in the development of the primate laboratory and then afterwards in the development of the primate center, one of the regional federally sponsored research centers using primates. But partly because these things were his baby, but also because of a strong identification with the university, he was greatly involved. He seemed to care very much about the university. In my experience with him, he didn't have very much small talk. When he talked about the university or about the department or about things psychological. But I think it was a reflection of the extent to which he was concerned.
Does this mean that it wasn't particularly easy to talk to him?
It really wasn't. I think to a certain extent he was almost always, at least with me, posing. He was playing a role. On one occasion I remember asking him a rather unimportant question about what psychology had been like before I myself came on the scene. And he didn't give me any straight answer at that particular time. But a little while later, I think it must have been an hour or two later, he came out with a poem that he had written as his answer. He seemed to be motivated to come out with a witticism or with something, some kind of a striking statement.
So he must have been very self-conscious.
I think he was exceedingly self-conscious. He cared very much about what people thought of him. He, the reputation was that he was very concerned about his standing in the university with regard to pay, for example, whether he was the third highest, fourth highest, fifth highest, second highest paid person in the university. That concerned him. He cared very much, evidently, whether beginning undergraduates dropped his introductory psychology course or not.
That's not at all one's notion of a great scholar.
Well.
Or isn't he a great scholar?
Oh, he was a great scholar. He knew a great deal, at least in my experience. He knew a great deal. And indeed, was interested in making significant contributions to the science, but he did care very much what people thought of him, what a full range of people thought of him. So perhaps for that reason, in my interactions with him, as I say, he seemed to be posing a good deal of the time. I'm not sure that anyone took offense at that. It was partly because I don't think anyone, I've never heard of Harlow doing anyone dirt, that he was malicious to anyone. And I think it was a widespread recognition that he was posing. For example, in his classes, he made very shocking statements about women. Yeah, I guess he was, in that respect, something of a sexist. But there was also a recognition that he was saying that partly to be shocking, to set people back on their heels. And it wasn't, as I say, intended to be mean. People seem to recognize that. It's just that he was trying to present himself in a particular manner.
Huh. I must say, I would have said that anybody who was a genuine scholar, and there certainly are those around here, is not somebody who is
posing.
Well, it sounds petty or posing.
Well, I think it's more a tribute to his insecurity. Self-consciousness, if you want to call it that. Oh, no, I think he was a genuine scholar, certainly a genuine scientist.
That's all been written up, I'm sure, the history of the primate lab and his putting his own...
Well, there's a... there's certainly a... you might be interested in this. There's an obituary of Harry Harlow that was just published in the latest issue of the American Psychologist, which is the one of the professional journals of the American Psychological Association. It's a two-page history of Harlow by one of the very eminent people in the field. So that's a tribute to his standing and indeed his significant contributions.
But that wouldn't go into the details of how he actually did start. You said that he went around scrounging
materials.
I mean, has anybody written that up?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Huh. He presumably right there on the premises. I mean, was never at the Zoo.
No. This was, they remodeled an old cheese factory. Over on, where is it? Near Regent Street, and what's the address? Orchard.
The primate lab is his.
Oh, yeah. Now there are two installations, the primate laboratory, which is still a psychology department installation, and the primate center, which is, as I said before, one of the regional centers paid for by the federal government. Those are administratively somewhat different. The center is supported by the federal government. The primate laboratory is supported by the College of Letters and Science.
How were his students and his relations with his students?
Well, he had Well, the short answer is I don't really know, but I don't know what they thought of him. He had some very good students, and I do know that he was in some respects very concerned about the welfare of his younger associates. He fought very hard for people who were working with him. He tried to improve their standing in many respects. For example, in the, I think it was in the 1960s, he had two young research associates who he tried very hard to have accepted in the psychology department and then become full-fledged members of the department. He went out of his way to get them that position, and he eventually succeeded over some misgivings. Mm-hmm. Then towards the end of his career, he had a special relationship with a young, very young associate named Steve Sumi. And also went out of his way to try to further Sumi's career.
Is that, how do you spell it?
Yes, it's a
son. S-U-O-M-I, I see.
Yeah, yes. He's a very, very active young man. Very active, hardworking, very ambitious. And as I say, Harlow worked very hard to further his career. I know, for example, that he nominated Steve Sumi for some special award being given out by the American Psychological Association, wrote a very glowing letter in support of young Sumi. So he was concerned about the people who were working for him and with him. But how he got along with these people, I don't know. I suppose his graduate students were in awe of him and somewhat intimidated by him, I suppose, because at first glance, Harlow, I think, would be somewhat hard to figure out.
Well, presumably you would have heard if there'd been, I mean, if as you knew of Roger's students, that you had an opinion about them.
Well, I didn't think they were less, I don't think they were too able.
Yeah, and whereas,
at least his students here. Charlie Truax, that's the man
we were talking about the
other day. Charlie Truax.
I've heard that, what were you going to say?
Nothing. Nothing worthwhile, anyway.
Well, I've heard that that somebody else in the end ran the primary lab, really. I mean, that Harlow became an alcoholic at some point.
Well, that is a kind of an exaggeration.
Oh.
Harry did drink a lot. There's no doubt about that. But the the extent to which he was inebriated, I think, was exaggerated. It turned out that he had Parkinson's disease.
Oh.
And that wasn't known. That wasn't widely known, at any rate. So a lot of the symptoms that were attributed to alcoholism, like weaving, and not being steady on his feet, and so forth. Yeah, I think it wasn't really known at first. Indeed, that point was made in this obituary that I mentioned as a way of trying to set the record straight. Mm-hmm. No, he did drink, but I think that he wasn't drunk much of the time, or at least all of the time, the way the story started to hold. He had several people run the primate lab. John Davenport was an administrator, a man who's now in the psychology department. Steve Sumi worked with him very closely towards the end, and so on. But I don't think anyone really wants to take credit away from Harlow. He definitely made some very significant contributions, at least to my knowledge. I've never heard of any accusations that the ideas were not his.
Well, is there anything else to say about him?
About Harlow? No, I think that sums up my experience of him. I guess I do want to give some credit to his second and his, what shall I say, his third and first wife. Do you know about this?
No.
Divorced his first wife, Clara, and married a former student, Margaret, who was also an exceedingly ambitious woman and who was a very notable psychologist in her own right. They collaborated on some projects, but she was also quite independent. And it was at that time that Harry made many of his most significant contributions, and Margaret Keane Harlow, I think that was her name, also became fairly well known herself. She was never a member of the psychology department because of the rules regarding nepotism that were so strong in those days. But she was a research associate at the primate laboratory and, as I say, became fairly well known. One of the things that happened was that Harlow and the Harlows, both of them, as I understand it, increasingly became social isolates during that period. They had less and less contact with others. They certainly had less contact with, and very little contact with, other people in the psychology department.
Maybe your monkeys were adequate company, you know?
Well, I don't know what it was. We didn't, well, in all of the years that I was here, we never had any social contact with Margaret and Harry Harlow.
That's rare, isn't it?
Well, somewhat unusual. At any rate, after Margaret died, she died of cancer. Harry remarried his first wife, who was by then a widow. And she came back to Madison and, to a certain degree, re-socialized him. She took him out into the world. She started widening his social contacts again. She was very good for him. And they also, I understand, collaborated on some projects. But again, to illustrate the story that I tell, to illustrate Harry's posing and his need to express witticisms, after he retired and they moved to a what I thought was a condominium on the west side, and they gave a party for some people at that time. So we went out for that party, and I asked Harry how he liked the condominium living. Harry looked at me and said, "A condominium is a way station on the road from the home to the tomb."
He was able to make moves like that.
I think it also illustrated how conscious he was of getting old. But at any rate, Clara was very, very good for him, as I understand it, at least from an outsider's perspective. He was very lucky in being able to get back together again with her.
And nice that she hadn't been sitting around waiting all the time.
Yes.
I made the comment about the monkeys because that, I suppose, of all the research that's been done at the UW, that's the what I most remember and knew
sure.
about before.
Sure.
I mean, it's such,
sure.
I think, in Scientific
sure.
American.
Sure.
I mean,
oh, yes, he had
marvelous.
A lot of. And also, psychiatrists were very interested in his work. I was at a convention with him once, and I remember how impressed I was how the psychiatrists in the audience were taking up his ideas with great
so.
Enthusiasm. Oh yes, but more so than many psychological studies. Many of them they would regard as either alien to their ways of thinking or not of special interest, but his work on the social development of the primates, they regarded as especially important.
Mm. Well, what about the reason I bring up Ed Psychology is that there was a letter in the files from Stiles to Archer. No, yes, or maybe
Dean Stiles, I've forgotten about him.
Is saying that the department's just been founded and we hope there'll be increasingly close ties.
I didn't know anything about that.
Yeah, I don't suppose so, and evidently there weren't.
I don't think so. I possibly in part because of Jim, who, as I indicated the other day, tended to be somewhat arrogant.
It may have been to Moat. Is his
name? Oh, Moat, Fred Moat.
It may have been that year.
Yeah.
But it was just one of those letters that one presumably files away.
Well, it could have been Moat. Moat was chairman when I came. It was part of the turn-taking aspect of being a department chairman. That was more or less his turn. I don't know anything about that.
All right.
Business.
Well, maybe we should just continue with departmental affairs. I guess that would be appropriate, which is to say, why were you given the violence professorship, and why did you accept the chairmanship?
Why did I accept it? The answer is very easy about the chairmanship. It was a matter of turn taking.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I found that I was not especially well suited to be chairman.
You certainly picked the worst possible time to
be chairman. Oh, that was a bad time for me. I'm much too excitable. And those were times that were, very excitable times.
Well,
I lost my cool on a number of occasions.
There was the TA strike, and then there was Dean Cleaney, who was rather hard on at least some department chairman.
Oh, well, I did get somewhat intense in my discussions with Dean Cleaney. I remember on one occasion he told me not to shout. But I think we
what were
generally...
What were you shouting about?
I don't remember.
Psychology was very upset. There are letters.
It had nothing to do with the student situation.
No,
it
was
more
hiring.
With hiring, yeah.
Yes, because you were letting people go because you didn't think they were good enough. But
yes.
You weren't being able to keep the money to get other people.
Well, I think it wasn't so much that. I remember on one occasion being concerned about finding a replacement for Mavis Hetherington, who I had mentioned the other day. She was, I think, a full professor at that time, was lured away to Virginia. And we were very concerned about finding an adequate replacement for her, and it was quite uncertain whether the dean would allow us. I think Kleene's philosophy, as Cronin's philosophy nowadays, is to allow departments, or at least many departments, to replace people they do not grant tenure to.
Mm-hmm.
So that it wasn't the question. It's the question of people who already have tenure, or who are being, who leave for one reason or another. It's about replacing
losing
those.
Losing the slot, yes.
Yeah. And that I remember being quite intense about, at least in some letters I wrote to Dean Kleene from California. No, I think that we were never under pressure from the administration whatsoever in connection with the student unrest. There were two such. One has to do with the TAs, but the other one had to do with the so-called Black Students Strike, the formation of the Black Studies program. On both of those occasions, and of course surrounding the Vietnam situation, there was a great deal of unrest. I was, as I say, much too excitable. On one occasion, the young militants, undergraduates in the psychology department, you know, they got the atmosphere, formed a kind of a radical student organization, and tried to remake the psychology department. So that on one occasion they came up with something like 13 non-negotiable demands and presented them to me.
Is this as TAs?
No, these were undergraduates.
These were
undergraduates. They want the changes in the course content and changes in the way of doing things, changes in the committee structure, but especially changes in the courses that were available and curriculum requirements. So when they presented to me with these demands, I looked at the sheet of paper and said, "What do you mean non-negotiable demands?" And became a bit excited about that kind of statement. The word quickly spread that Berkowitz had lost his cool, and that was apparently a very great reinforcement for the students. You know, they had made an impact. Yeah. They enjoyed that.
So what happened?
All of that died down. All of nothing. We nowadays find it very difficult to involve students in the department activities and committees and so forth. Mrs. Davenport, our undergraduate student advisor, does find occasional students, and she works very hard to try to keep a psychology club going with interested students. But except for those few highly interested undergraduates, the student body as a whole doesn't seem to care very much at all about what's going on. At least as far as I'm able to see, I don't hear very much intense interest. It's a good thing we have Mrs. Davenport, because she maintains some degree of interest, some degree of undergraduate involvement.
Were those positions new, those undergraduate student advisors? Each department seems
yes,
to have one, though.
That's right. That came about, I think, in the mid-60s, if my memory is concerned. I don't think every department. I think most, but not every.
Well, maybe the big department.
Yes.
I know history and economics.
Right. And they are a good idea. They are, in my experience, very, very worthwhile. When I first came here, I served as a student advisor, as did every staff member. Students would come in and discuss with us about courses and so forth. Many of us tended not to know the rules too well. And also, perhaps more important, we didn't really care very much about the rules or even
you
about...
You mean what was required and what not?
That's right, the college rules, the university rules. We didn't keep up to date with whatever changes in regulations, curriculum requirements, graduation requirements. And I don't think many of us were especially concerned about these particular matters. And of course, there was a certain amount of resentment even about having to spend the time in this way.
Yeah.
When the undergraduate advisors came on the scene in the mid-60s, we were very fortunate in obtaining the services of Mrs. Davenport, John Davenport's wife, because she is highly motivated to fulfill this role, very, very interested in working with students, and does, as far as I'm able to see, a superb job. The students are getting much better advice, much better information from her than I believe they ever got from faculty members. Of course, a number of students say they miss contact with faculty members. But the way for students to obtain that contact is by trying to work with a faculty member on an independent research project. You know, to sometimes students work either for pay or for course credit, doing research under the supervision of a faculty member. That's the way the students can get that contact, rather than through asking a faculty member whether they should take geology or chemistry, or the other kind of advice that we used to be sought out for.
Well, presumably they could, if they're in your class, they can come in and talk to you in your office hours too.
That's right. And I have gotten to know some students that way. But as far as getting advice,
that's one of the observations. I have done a lot of interviews on the TA strike. Was the very close relationship among the graduate students, and what a source of excitement and pleasure and intimacy it was for them.
Oh yes, I bet they sort of drew together. They developed a real sense of community, didn't they?
And it would have been very hard to resist it, no matter how...
Sure.
How
sure.
My department relations.
Oh yeah. I think that things were exciting in those days. As I say, I don't think the psychology TAs felt that they were exploited or treated unfairly. I think in large part they felt that they had to psychologically align themselves with their peers.
Yeah. Did this make them hostile to you? Or?
I don't know. I can't recall any incidents of hostility.
Oh, you're lucky.
It took place around us. Remember attempts, of course, to injure the chemistry building, which is across the way. Some, I think it was TAs, tried to make some holes in that big tank right outside the chemistry building. But nothing of that sort ever happened in psychology. As I recall, there was picketing. Some of our TAs picketed the building, but I don't think it ever went beyond that. I don't recall. The time, it wasn't the TAs or the TA strike that led to that intense feeling, at least in connection with the psychology. Wait a minute. I think that was the black. Let's see. Let me take it back. There was one occasion. And I, it may have been the TA strike or not. Perhaps it was the TA strike. This is the only incident I remember where some students invaded a classroom. The class was actually being taught by Mavis Hetherington, who I've mentioned several times. And they insisted that they tried to get the students in the classroom to leave. And so they tried to break up the class. Mavis, being a tough cookie, wasn't going to give up her classes, wasn't going to not teach. She was very serious about her work. She insisted on fulfilling her obligations. Well, the invading students, I think, threw a table at her. They couldn't throw it very far, but it was just as an expression of their hostility and frustration. Mavis came running upstairs at that point, sought me out as chairman and started crying. And I think that had an impact on her, considerable impact on her. There was another occasion, if my memory serves me right, in which some striking students invaded the classroom, being taught by K.U. Smith. K.U. Smith was also a man of very, very decided opinions, very
He's
strong.
The one you said would have a quite different view of the department.
Oh, yes. Oh, you've got
Is
to.
Is it K.U.?
Yes. Okay. You, if any history of the psychology department would be seriously incomplete without K.U. Smith, you have to get him.
All right.
Well, at any rate, what K.U. did, as I understand, was to grab a pointer and threaten the students with it, the invading students, in a sense, chase them out of the room. I think we all applauded, at least in our heads, this action. But I think that, as I said, my memory is unclear. I don't remember whether that was the TA strike or the black students' strike. By the way, the black students' strike was really promulgated by, in many respects, white students. But certainly it was white students who tried to disrupt the psychology building at that time in connection with that strike in support of the demand for a black studies program. At least in our experience, that whatever disruption was created at that time was created by white students.
I don't know much about that. People haven't said much about it. Were there many, I mean, was it a question of black students in the psychology department who...
No.
Who...
there were no black...
And they were working on behalf of, or...?
No, they were working in behalf of demands elsewhere for a black studies program.
So it had nothing to do with psychology?
No, but as part of their efforts to intimidate the university, they tried to disrupt classes, even prevent students from going to classes. On a couple of occasions when I was chairman, they tried to block entrance to the psychology building. And that was another occasion in which I lost my cool.
Well, what did you do?
Oh, I rushed downstairs with a pad of yellow, a yellow pad, and said, "Give me your names, give me your names." They ignored me.
Here you're a student of aggression. What was your attitude about this whole period?
Oh, I didn't support these endeavors in any way. I don't think my research on aggression had anything to do with my attitudes.
You weren't called upon by the authorities.
No.
Because you might have been, you know.
No. The only thing that I The only possible contribution I made might have made had to do not with the student strikes, but the in connection with the TAs or the Black Studies program, but the some of the protests in the connection with the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, I'm including, that's what I'm really mostly talking about now.
Okay. Now, the you might recall that the authorities, especially at first, were really at a loss as to how to handle the protests. For example, when students took over a building,
mm-hmm.
or when they started, well, let's say took over a building. And also, I must be getting away from that, but it was again the same era. Remember in the late, in the mid and late 60s, around 66, 67, there was a tremendous amount of urban disorders.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what I was professionally more involved in. That's really what I should talk about. I was professionally more involved in the urban disorders, and so I served as a consultant for the Commission on Violence that had been established by Lyndon Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And on one occasion, I wrote a theoretical paper dealing with how crowds of protesters might be stimulated to increased violence by the sight of police.
Mm-hmm.
So, and argued on the basis of that, that authorities should, and that is from a theoretical point of view, that authorities should use either an overwhelming show of force or no force, and that having just a few police around was worse than anything else.
Prophetic.
So I, that came to be the policy that was used. I don't think it was because of my analysis. Rather, it was experience that taught the various authorities that that was the procedure to be employed. But in some jurisdictions, I was told that this paper, or at least the ideas that I had expressed, in a sense, served to justify and sort of give the police bodies some confidence that this was indeed a kind of course of action. But I think otherwise, my so-called expertise didn't have any impact, and I didn't have any real contributions to make.
But you must have been very interested in how it was happening.
Oh, I was very interested. I was interested in the source of the turmoil, especially with regard to the urban disorders. Mm-hmm. The blacks, of course, had many legitimate complaints. I disagreed with a number of people, especially with some political scientists and sociologists, who saw the riots as being rational attempts on the part of blacks to improve their political situation and their economic situation. Mm-hmm. I viewed much of what was going on as non-rational behavior. For example, the blacks in many ways were hurting other blacks. The property they destroyed very often, but not always, but very often, was owned by blacks. They attacked targets that they saw as bothering them, but it wasn't in a rational political way that they were behaving. So I, in my writings, emphasized the impulsive, irrational, highly emotional nature of the behavior, especially at first. But at any rate, I was really professionally more interested in the urban disorders than the student activities on the campus.
But when it actually started here, I mean, things like the sit-in at the at Peterson Building and the two Dow demonstrations.
Yeah.
You must have sort of cast an eye out the window and said...
Oh, yeah, I was very interested. I was very interested in what was going on. But only as an individual faculty member rather than as a psychologist. If I had been asked what to do from a professional point of view, there's no doubt what my advice would have been. I believed then and believe now that in part, the students wanted attention. And that their behavior, in a sense, was reinforced by having the building surrounded by police and having all of the photographers there and the television cameras all focused on them. They, as a matter of fact, we see that even nowadays when terrorists take over some kind of an installation. Yeah. They're reinforced by media attention. Not to say that the students were terrorists, but that there were some similarities. Paying a lot of attention to these actions is rewarding. It sort of encourages the people. Well, believing that, I wished that the regents and the authorities would have had the wisdom to really ignore the students.
But if they had, wouldn't the students have done even more at least
no, I don't
to
think
get
so.
Some attention finally?
Oh, they might have been frustrated, perhaps. Yeah. But I think, for example, suppose they took over South Hall or took over the dean's office in South Hall. I would have said, all right, let them stay there for a day, 2 days, 3 days, a week, whatever. Just make believe that they don't exist. And try to do the business elsewhere. Of course, the regents and the police would not have stood for that. They wanted to punish, to get these kids, to show them who's boss. But that, as I say, I think really was a reinforcement. It would have been far more effective just to ignore them.
It really is funny that nobody thought of calling on you. Here you were a national expert on the handling of... I mean, isn't it?
Yeah, well, no, I think that that kind of advice just would not have been welcome. Mm.
Nobody thought of calling.
Oh, no, but again, I don't see why. Everyone, on matters of this sort, everyone has strong opinions.
They're all themselves. They're part of the study.
Everyone's involved, and everyone knows what to do. Everyone has strong opinions. Mm.
What were your own opinions? Were you also against the war?
I don't think I was opposed to the war at the start, but certainly, let's say by the last year of the Johnson administration, I had awakened to the futility of it all. I guess I didn't believe that, what was it, in 65, let's say in 1965, I thought, believing in the Munich analogy. Mm-hmm. I did believe in the Munich, and I thought that with Dean Rusk and the other members of the Kennedy and Johnson administration in 1965, perhaps early 1966, thought there might be some benefit to being involved in Vietnam. But after, I think, maybe 67, I had changed my mind. Mm. You know, I would recommend that you, let me, I don't want to, closes off, but I do feel that I should go. But what I would like to do is, again, to recommend that you have some people talk to you about their experiences with KU.
Who would I?
People who were, for example, Bill Epstein, who was chairman of the psychology department after me. Or Len Ross, who's chairman now.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Epstein in particular, he started out being quite neutral in his view of KU. KU had not done anything to him, but he sort of changed his mind.
You have Epstein here in 44, didn't he, Smith?
Smith.
48.
Now, Smith is definitely, I don't know when Smith came.
Yeah.
Smith is definitely one of the colorful characters. My feelings towards him are very mixed. I think he was in many ways irresponsible. As a matter of fact, I would say that it's interesting how much tolerance there was. He made many libelous accusations towards people, including, not to me. He was very, very critical of me towards the end. Not because I'd ever done anything to him, but because I was starting to become visible and playing an important role in the department. So he started focusing on me. But he was irresponsible and even libelous in many accusations he made, especially of Grant, particularly Brogdon, and then also Harlow. And he frequently referred to Brogdon, Harlow, and Grant as those academic gangsters, in public as well as in private. He wrote letters to all sorts of state and national figures.
That must be in the files. I wonder if it is.
But at any rate, I think it would be helpful for you to get his view.
Is he a scholar himself?
He was a very, very active researcher, exceedingly.
Does he produce anything important?
Well, he would say so.
Oh, okay.
He certainly did a lot of research. I don't know what contributions they've made to the field as a whole. I don't know. I really don't know.
All right. Okay.
So what I say is you should talk to him and also talk to others about him.
Yeah. All right, but just give me a few minutes on what, as you think, from the period since you were here, of the presidents, the deans, people you've known, issues that you've known about, things happening on the campus, what seemed to you the most important things and the people,
I don't know quite what is the most important part. When I first came, the university had about 17,000 people, as I think I said the other day. It's now about 40,000. Mm-hmm. I, in many ways, regret the change. It certainly was quite comfortable and more congenial in the other days. Of course, it was inevitable, and I have very somewhat mixed feelings about our growth. In part, I'm sorry that the psychology department did not grow as much as it was able to, as it might have done. I mentioned the other day that we were very conservative in our hiring. We could have grown larger. We perhaps should have grown larger. We certainly should have done a somewhat different kind of hiring in order to maintain our visibility as an important place. So I'm sorry that that didn't happen. But on the other hand, it's comfortable being in a somewhat small department. You asked me about how I became a violist professor. The answer is that I was offered a chair at the University of Michigan.
Yeah, I thought it must have been something like that.
It was a Walgreens chair. I told some people that I would have had to have worked in the drugstore only 2 days a week. But it was, I guess my Vilas professorship most directly was a response to that offer. The people involved, especially Dean Epstein at that time, said that the Vilas was really not a counteroffer. It would have come about any time, anyway. But most direct as he really was, yeah. I don't think that would happen nowadays, but because it's the whole procedure for selecting Vilas professors now is somewhat more formal, certainly more involved. But at any rate, one of the reasons, there are several reasons why I decided to remain here at Wisconsin, partly because the real attractions of the place, partly because of the Vilas professorship, which is a very nice set of perks, and partly because I regarded the Michigan department as much too large, and this place is much, much more comfortable. There are, I would say, close to 200 people in the Michigan psychology department in various ways. There's research associates, people who have nominal or nominal appointments of one sort or another. But it's a huge department. And even though I had done my graduate work there and knew a fair number of the people there, and indeed have a tremendous respect for the department, I didn't care for that size, for the just being one of a great number of people. I found this place to be much more congenial, the small size to be much more congenial. So it is comfortable, but I think also we have missed some opportunities to get the kinds of people we need in order to maintain our visibility. You say about changes in the place. One of the things that's always impressed me is that in the heyday of the growth, when universities were growing, when universities seemed to have a tremendous amount of money, this university did not become as entrepreneurial, in my estimation, as a number of other places, especially places like Michigan. Mm-hmm. You know, private universities such as Stanford went all out to buy talent to eminent names. We didn't choose that route, partly because we didn't have the funds that Stanford had, but also Michigan went that way to a very great extent. They saw themselves as big time, and they went out to achieve national eminence by hiring big names throughout the university. As I see it, I don't think that the University of Wisconsin has done that.
Is that because Lindsay Harrington was president then?
Yeah.
Of course, subsequently.
Maybe it's the not having leadership that emphasized this, as you now seem to be implying. Maybe it's partly a shortage of funds. But I think it's also the culture of the place.
You can always get grants for hiring people.
Oh, there are all sorts of things. I think money was available. I think the psychology department could have done far more. But I put a good deal of the answer on the culture of the place as being partly provincial, partly small time. Mm-hmm. We didn't think of ourselves as being Well, we weren't being driven by an image of ourselves as being one of the top two or three, four or five or so forth. We believed more in bringing people along, which is good and bad, at least from the point of view of national visibility.
Of course, some departments, that is usually in the university, it's some departments that are very...
Some departments do that more readily than others. The economics department, in my experience, does that, and perhaps even history, I don't know.
Well, history used... It didn't go out for big names, but it got very good people.
Yeah. But I mean, it's going out for the big names.
Yeah.
Economics did that. You mentioned Orcutt the other day.
Yes.
Yes,
there was stunned surprise apparently in the New York Times when he accepted the position out here.
Oh, really?
Hmm.
Well, that's a relatively unusual phenomenon in my experience here at Madison.
Who are the best people or the good people in the department now?
Well, I think the department is pretty good in general. There are a lot of good people. Again, as I said the other day, I'm not sure that we have major theoretical innovators, but they're all good people. Well, some people who have ceased publishing, but by and large, I think everyone is good,
there
or
are
many.
Two or three that you pick out as
the ones who have perhaps great visibility are Frances Graham, who is interested in child development. She's part-time in pediatrics as well as in the psychology department. Lauren and Jean Chapman, who are in clinical psychology. They're very well known, Lauren especially, for research on schizophrenia. Steve Sumi, of course, for his interest in primate research and social development generally. A number of experimental psychologists have some degree of visibility. But we certainly don't have anybody that has the kind of stature that Brogdon became old-fashioned rather soon. But let's say Harlow or
what
even Grant.
What about yourself? Do you think? I know you have as you, apparently one of the two from the university produced this. Most number of cited works in a...
Well, I wouldn't give too much weight to that kind of thing. I think that...
Well, I suppose I can't ask you that. I mean,
No. I'm really being quite honest. I think that the way social psychology, my particular field, has developed, I am somewhat peripheral.
Oh, that's right. Like you said that social psychology was no longer the main field.
No. That's not what I was saying.
Mm.
Social psychology is susceptible to rapid changes. I don't know if other fields...
That's right. You said aggression was no longer...
That's right. Yes. Aggression is no longer really of interest. For that, they can go even a little more. It can be even a little broader. I think the study of social interaction is no longer of central importance. People aren't doing research on conformity or